I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. A recent study found that adults spend more than half of their day, about 55% of their time, being sedentary, mostly sitting. Think about your day. Does it sound like that? And I'll admit it, mine does. There are health risks associated with that behavior, especially for men, according to a new study published by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We asked one of the authors of the study to join us. Carolyn Barlow is senior epidemiologist at the Cooper Institute at Dallas, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here with you, too.
How do you define sedentary?
In our study, we assigned people to different groups. They were asked to report their sitting behavior in kind of broad groups, 0%, 25%, 50%, 75%, and 100% of their day.
And the finding, I guess the one of their many findings here, one of them I had in my introduction, which is that most adults spend about half of their day being sedentary?
Yes, that's what the national data show us, that most U.S. adults spend the majority of their day sitting.
What are the highs and lows of being sedentary? What are the highs and lows that you found in this study? Are there people that spend no time sitting?
There were a few people that reported 0%. This was a kind of crude measure estimate. But we did have patients to report that.
And what were you looking to find out?
We just wanted to see whether their sitting behavior was associated with any risk factors like obesity, their cholesterol levels, glucose.
And what did you find?
We found that in men, that sitting time was associated with being obese. And no matter how we measured obesity, whether we measured their waist size or their BMI or their percent body fat, if they sat more, they were more likely to be obese.
What does that tell you? Is there something unique about men's physiology or how they sit or perhaps even how much they sit?
That our guys tended to sit more than our women did. So there appears to be, at least in our study group, a difference in gender there and the amount of sitting that they're getting.
So women sat less in your study group?
Yes, in our study group they did.
Could it be said that men that sat more got more obese, which meant that they sat more? Is there a kind of a circular pattern that can happen here?
Well, you're right. It could. We can't really tease that apart with our study design because we basically took a snapshot of them at one point in time and looked at their obesity level and their sitting level at one point in time. And I think that you've hit on the next study that we need to do is to look forward. So we have sitting time perhaps at two different visits to the clinic, and then we can see how that associates with their risk factors. So we can look at change.
Did this surprise you, these findings?
Not surprising. I was probably a little surprised that we didn't see the same association in women that we did in men. I thought that we would see the obesity risk factor. The other risk factors, the literature is varied there. Some studies have found sitting to be associated with like glucose and some haven't. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't surprised we didn't find that.
And just to underscore, I guess, the difference between men and women, are you telling us that at least in this study, women are more or were more active than men?
Yes. Yes, our particular study group, yes.
And what does that tell us?
That it's a good idea to be more active. We did not see the association in women with obesity that we did with the men. So I think, and of course, that is always at Cooper, that is our message, is to be active. There are lots of health benefits to being active.
Is there also some kind of association with mortality or morbidity?
Oh, yes, definitely. In terms of sitting or physical activity?
Both.
They're actually both are. So more sitting is associated with increased levels of morbidity and mortality, and physical activity, it's the inverse.
As you said, you're going to be studying some more. Obviously, every study, I guess, raises questions that you can use for a new study. And in just a moment or two before we have to say goodbye to you, what do you expect to do next?
Well, as I stated, I think that there are some exciting things that we can do with the new technologies coming out. I want to look at change in behavior and how that impacts risk factors, putting monitors on patients. To really get an idea of their activity or lack of activity during the day, the entire day. You know, we just looked at kind of some crude measures of sitting and their physical activity levels just at leisure time. But if I can put a monitor on a patient, right, then I can learn what they're doing the entire 24 hours. So,
and you mentioned, and you mentioned technology, the idea that there might be some technological fixes.
Fixes. There are definitely, I think, with some of the new technology, we can get reminders out to people that they've been sitting too long and they need to get up and move. There, I think, a lot of potential with the new technologies coming out.
Has this affected your behavior? I'm sitting here talking to you. I've been sitting pretty much all morning.
Yes, I, like you, have a very sedentary job, and so I have to remind myself to, you know, get up at least once an hour and move around, because I am rather tied to my computer, and I do block out time during the day to go work out. So
a sedentary lifestyle is hazardous to our health. Can we say that?
I believe so.
Well, Carolyn,
evidence is pointing that way.
Yes, and I appreciate you joining us on Radio Times. Carolyn Barlow, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're welcome. And she's senior epidemiologist at the Cooper Institute in Dallas, Texas. As I mentioned, most of us spend a lot of our day sitting. I sat during my commute today. I sat at my desk when I got up, got to work earlier this morning. I'm sitting right now. I'll do some more sitting this afternoon. And our sedentary lifestyle does have health consequences. The cure is incorporating more movement, more activity into our daily routine and making sure our workspace supports our body, so we're not, for instance, hunched over our keyboard all day long. And joining us to talk more about this issue is Alan Hedge. He's a professor of ergonomics at Cornell University. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you as well. Also with us is James Levine. He's director of the Mayo Clinic, the Arizona State University Solutions Initiative, and the inventor of the treadmill desk. And James Levine, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Absolute pleasure.
Pleasure. And it's interesting that you're both Brits joining us on Radio Times talking about the importance of not sitting all day long. I was just talking with Carolyn Barlow about this study that was in the CDC about, I guess, just underscoring the fact that sitting can be hazardous to our health. To you, James Levine, and then to you, Alan Hedge, does this just underscore what we have known, or perhaps what you have known for some time now?
Yes, I think it does. The NIH consensus identified about 34 different chronic diseases and conditions that are negatively impacted by sitting for too long. And so this sort of adds fuel to the fire. We need to get up and find amenable and practical solutions for so doing.
Well, going back to you, Alan, I know you have a 28-10 formula, or I guess ratio, that you think helps deal with this problem. Explain what you mean by that.
So we know that the issue is not that sitting necessarily is bad, but as James said, too much sitting is bad, and sitting in poor postures is bad. And we've known for a long time in ergonomics that if you can break work up into shorter work intervals and give people the ability to change their posture and give them the ability to move, then that improves their health over the course of time. And also it could potentially improve their performance. And so based on quite a bit of research, we developed this idea of trying to encourage people to think about sitting for 20 minutes at a time, standing for 8 minutes, moving for 2 minutes, and repeating that kind of cycle through the day. And by doing that, you end up with about 5 hours of sitting, which matches the sort of World Health Organization research recommendations. You end up with 30 minutes of moving, which we have quite a bit of evidence showing that reduces cardiovascular risks. You end up with a total of about 2 hours of standing in the day, and that seems to be an acceptable amount of standing. We don't want people standing for too long because that can be equally bad to sitting for too long. With modern technology, you can do this. I mean, at the moment, I'm talking to you on a mobile phone and I'm walking around. And if I know James, and I have no doubt that he's doing the same
thing. He's probably on his treadmill.
Well. He may be on the treadmill, yes. And, you know, I mean, if you actually go back, you know, for example, on the treadmill, the first paper published on that was back in 1989. But then computers were great big clunky things, so you were limited to what you could actually do. And back then, they were looking at 20 minutes of moving as a way of breaking up the stress associated with computer use. We've kind of lost that idea that work can be stressful.
Since we're all attached to our computers.
So what we're trying to do is look at how can you change the design of the work, the technology, the environment that a person's in, so that they automatically behave in a way that encourages more movement. So you know, the problem with tracking your steps is that if you've not made your 10,000 steps at the end of the day, you go crazy, and that doesn't particularly help you. So that's what we're trying to do.
Sure.
Build greater activity into everyday work because technology now allows that.
And I do want to pick up on that too, James Levine, but we're about a minute away from our first break here. Help us out. What happens to our body when we are sitting?
I mean, it's rather like sort of idling your Ferrari. I mean, basically.
yes, my Ferrari. But yes, no, go ahead, James Levine.
I actually mean your third Ferrari. Sorry, I've been terribly disrespectful. You know, of course, what happens if we sort of sit down for too long is essentially all the systems clog up. And I don't just mean sort of the arteries and the veins and sort of venous stasis and, you know, and swelling of the ankles and back pain and the joints and so on and so forth. I also mean the mind and the intellect. I mean, the data are actually quite good, but if you actually sort of sit down for too long, your sort of mind goes into sort of what I call Facebook mode, you know, where you sort of spend the entire afternoon sort of clicking around and achieve nothing. Get up in kind of the formulation Alan suggests, and you're going to sort of switch back on again. We're really not designed to sit all day. And that's sort of what the thrust of the data are teaching us.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's James Levine, director of the Mayo Clinic at Arizona State University's Solutions Initiative, inventor of the treadmill desk. Alan Hedge with us as well. He's a professor of ergonomics at Cornell University. We are talking about the fact that we sit too much and what we can do about it. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Alan Hedge and James Levine about why and how too much sitting is not good for us and what we can do instead. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. I want to pick up on something you said earlier, Alan, about that standing can also have problems as well. Explain what you mean.
Well, we know that people who have to stand all day to do work have a much higher risk of certain kind of cardiovascular problems. They have, for example, higher risks of varicose veins. You can get an increased risk of some carotid artery disease. You can actually get increased back pain. You can get increased foot problems. And so it's a good idea to allow people who have to stand a lot, for example, nurses in hospitals, to occasionally sit down because the chair really is an anti-gravity device that's allowing the body and the muscles of the body to relax. But you just don't want to sit for too long. And I think that's the key here. Mix it up throughout the day. In California, for example, they passed a regulation recently that says if your job involves you standing all day, the employer has to provide you with a chair so you can occasionally sit down. Mm. because we sit down when we feel tired, and that helps the body rest for a little while, and then we can stand up and we can move around. Standing, if you're standing still, is extraordinarily hard to do. And so people who have to stand at work and work in a static posture also experience a higher level of musculoskeletal problems. So when we talk about people standing, we also want to build moving into that. And that's where the idea of stretching or moving around becomes important as well.
Let me get, looks like Bill from Chester County to join our conversation. And Bill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I had a question about defining sitting, for instance. I think a lot of the people in an office are probably just sitting in a cubicle, perhaps, and looking at a computer screen. I drive a dump truck for a living, and I'm constantly moving, it seems. I mean, unless I'm doing a highway trip. But a lot of times I'm bouncing around in my seat and, I guess, using a lot of little muscles to correct my left foot for the clutch, my right foot for the brake and the gas, my right hand for shifting gears, and my left hand for steering.
Sure.
So I feel like I'm constantly moving, but I don't know if that really counts as sitting or where it fits in or how to decide on how much activity that really counts for.
Well, Bill, that's a great question. I'm going to toss that to James Levine.
I have a couple of comments, if I may. I mean, the first concept about posture, I'm going to allow Alan to comment on. He's literally one of the world authorities on this. However, we've actually proposed and then rescinded a series of proposals looking at encouraging people to move who drive a lot. Now, the reason, of course, these were rescinded is that one cannot possibly recommend anything that distracts from the actual act of driving. However, the world is changing. We're moving into an era where driverless cars are imminent. And to me, this could be one of the greatest opportunities. So instead of as one sort of being sort of driven around from A to B by some, you know, automated system, what an amazing opportunity to view that as sort of active time. And so as we sort of think through the implications of, you know, if one lives in Los Angeles, you can be driving 2 to 3 hours a day. What an amazing opportunity that could be for human health to displace that sitting time for active time. And the issue of posture, I'll very politely hand on to Alan.
Well, let me ask you just one question there, James, because I'm thinking about what it takes to drive a dump truck, as Bill does. And I know that you've looked at things like fidgeting, you know, the fact that people wiggle and waggle their feet around, that actually can register as at least some form of activity.
Yes, it's actually very, very interesting. The data suggests that if you actually look at fidgeting movements, i.e. those not particularly associated with posture, we all know, you know, when your hand jiggers, that kind of thing.
Right.
What's very interesting is that appears to reflect upon the amount of movement one subsequently does throughout the day. So if you're a fidgeter, you tend to be more active. And what we think is probably going on there is the fidget is actually, and this is absolutely incredibly fascinating when you think about it, is actually the brain's signal to your body to move.
Huh.
And if you're actually in a sort of activity permissive environment, you know, whatever that may be, or, you know, just sort of in society, so to speak, that signal to fidget becomes a movement. So it's your brain signal to get up and move. If, however, one lives in sort of a sitting predominant society, in other words, we said we're sort of forced to sit behind a computer screen and so on, that fidget, which is the initiative to move, gets suppressed. And when you start thinking about it that way, your caller's very interesting predisposition to fidget may sort of predicate the idea of, you know, you stop the truck and go for a half an hour walk and that kind of thing.
Let me go to you, Alan, as the ergonomics expert part of our panel today. What do you say, though, to Bill and even just the design of a truck cab? Is that ergonomically helpful?
Well, yes and no. And let me tell you about a couple of things. There's a classic study that was actually done in the UK looking at bus drivers on double-decker buses versus bus conductors. These are in the days when you had a conductor who went round and collected the fare, climbed up the stairs to the upper deck and went back down. So both the driver and the conductor were spending the same amount of time in the bus. The results show that the driver was at a much higher risk of cardiovascular disease than the conductor. So small movements are useful, but they're not enough. If you're going to drive, then you need to break that up with periods when you're actually moving around and walking, which is why we have recommendations that you should break a drive up every couple of hours and get out of the car and move around. The same thing is in terms of ergonomics. People who drive a lot for a living have a much higher risk of low back injury than people who don't, not because of simply sitting for a long time, but the fact that you're being bounced around. So it very much depends on the quality of the seat that you're sitting on. And that gets evaluated by measuring how much your spine shrinks over the course of a day. There's natural shrinkage because of gravity compressing the body. But also, if you're on a badly designed truck seat, you shrink a lot more than if you're on a well-designed truck seat. And then there are some behavioral factors that become important. For example, drivers who put a wallet in one side of their jeans in the back pocket end up with more back problems than drivers who don't, because it leads to them actually sitting in a twisted posture, and that puts more torque on the lower back. So it's not a simple answer to what sounds like a simple question. It very much depends on how that truck's being designed. But as far as we know, at least from the UK data, all of the arm and leg movement without the change in posture is important, but not enough. That actually comes back to some work that was done by NASA looking at the importance of gravitational stimulation. And their work showed that you need to change your posture at a minimum of 16 times a day for the body to know that we're in gravity. And if the body doesn't know that, a whole variety of bad things begin to happen within the body. And over time, you become weaker and bones become more brittle. So I would say to anybody who's a truck driver, see if there are ways that you can actually break your day up. It doesn't have to be for very long. The NASA research shows that taking a break in just 2 minutes of moving around is enough. So if you can stop the truck every hour and just, you know, go outside for just 2 minutes, walk around the truck, make sure everything's in good condition, get back in the truck and drive, something as simple as that is going to actually improve your health over time.
Bill, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and you can call as well. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We're talking about the hazards of sitting too much. And the voice you heard is Alan Hedge. He's a professor of ergonomics at Cornell University. Also joining us by telephone, James Levine, director of the Mayo Clinic and inventor of the treadmill desk. Let me go back to you, James Levine. And there was an interesting report that I saw in NPR by Patty Naiman. She talked about getting a treadmill desk. And then it turned out after about a month or so, she stopped using it. And I wonder what that tells us. And she talks about a couple of studies where people had all the best intentions of the world, but when it came down to actually using the treadmill desk, that behavior kind of fell off. What does that tell us, and what can be done about it?
To me, that tells us sort of several absolutely sort of critical things. The first comment I'd make is, like everything in life, one size doesn't fit all. Some people like jogging, some people like walking, some people like playing tennis. Everyone is sort of very, very different. And one of the problems we have in science is basically assuming that everybody is the same, that groups act the same as other groups, and that just isn't the case. So for some people, and we literally did a 2-year prospective randomized clinical trial looking at how treadmill desks impact people's health. And, of course, the data look very, very interesting, but what's more fascinating is what happened to real people. So we had a person who was given one of these machines who lowered it down to the sitting position and continued. It was a gentleman, his work exactly as before. In other words, he never even activated the treadmill belt because that isn't what he liked to do. He felt unsure of being able to complete his work task while sort of walking, albeit at only 1 mile an hour. Now, you might say, well, that was a sort of a terrible waste of money. But what it does is it sort of reflects on exactly the individual you're talking about. Because for some people, you know, the better thing might be, not that she necessarily purchased a desk and so on and so forth, but she actually does her writing. I think she's a journalist, as you say, but then does her meetings whilst walking with the individual she's sort of having those meetings with. In other words, if she does 3 hours of interviews, that's 3 hours of gentle walking every single day and writing her stories while seated. On the other hand, you have sort of Einstein who came up with E equals MC squared while cycling across, campus. Also used to complete his original work at a standing desk, sort of quite interestingly, in the patent office. And so everybody is very, very different. On the other hand, I've had this bizarre phone call. Literally, I don't know how they got hold of me through the Mayo switchboard at 5 a.m. It was a gentleman who said to me, Dr. Levine, I have to tell you this. Yesterday, I was at work and covered a half marathon. And I just thought that was absolutely absurd. But I understood where he was coming from. In other words, for some people, it is absolutely wonderful. And so what I think is really the take-home message here is that you have to find what is right for you, what fits in with your work practice, what fits in with your bosses and your productivity demands, right? We all have those. But in addition to that, different things appeal to different people, and finding what's right for you is critical.
So he ran, quote unquote, a half marathon while at work. I guess 13 miles,
no,
right?
He walked a half marathon. He walked a half marathon whilst at work, and of course, one assumes completed everything he had to do. But it's just that contrast. You have on one hand somebody who had the equipment and never even touched it. On the other hand, you got somebody who literally was covering 13 miles, which is sort of quite atrocious when you think about it.
I'm glad you said that.
during a work day. And so my point is that you have, we're all in between that. Yes, I have a treadmill desk, but I don't use it all the time. Right. During my conference calls, yes, I'm using it, particularly in the afternoon. Yes, I'm using it to stop me sort of drifting off asleep, so to speak. However, sometimes when I have sort of face-to-face meetings with students who are worried about something, then we sit down properly and discuss those very, very calmly. If I'm writing poetry, I'll sit at my dining room table and look out the window. And so there are times to walk and there are times to sit. And breaking things up, however, appears to be the critical. But finding what's right for you is the most important thing of all.
Alan, let me go back to you. And I'm curious about whether you can look at someone working at their desk or in their office and diagnose what they're doing wrong. Is it obviously visible to you?
Usually, yes, it is. Ergonomists over the past 30 years have developed a variety of tools. We call them posture targeting tools. In effect, position of the various parts of the body are telling you something about what's happening inside the body in terms of the muscle action that's happening, and also the likelihood that you'll have either free or restricted blood flow to certain regions of the body. And those posture targeting tools allow you to assess the risk that a person is experiencing, the risk of developing musculoskeletal injury. So we've been able to use that very effectively to help to improve the design of both workstations and then workplaces, because to try and do what, Jim is absolutely right about breaking things up and moving around, in a lot of organizations, they don't have the wherewithal to buy new equipment for everybody, but they can make simple changes that mean that people have to move more. And so that's what we've been looking at. For example, one thing that we've seen that's quite effective is getting rid of waste bins.
Really? Why is that?
Desk.
Waste bins, why?
Well, because what you do is you put a waste bin at the end of the office. Now when somebody has to throw something away, they have to get up and walk to it and throw things away. And in a very nice study done in a company in Manhattan, they showed that not only did that change the amount of material that was thrown away, but it increased the amount of interaction between individuals. A lot of times these days, work is not done in isolation. It's done in consultation with other people. And so if you can move people in a way that increases the chance of encounters, that becomes extremely important. And James was right about people like Einstein moving around to have ideas. If you look at the one laboratory that has the most Nobel
Nobel Prizes, which is the Rutherford Lab in Cambridge, they had a policy that every morning and afternoon, researchers would go for a stroll along the banks of the River Cam, and they would talk, and that generated a lot more ideas. Why is that happening? Well, when you're moving, you're increasing blood flow. You're getting more oxygen to the brain as well. And so you're also giving the body that gravitational stimulation of going from sitting to standing. So it becomes really important to look at how do you create variety in the workplace and how do you mix things up.
Sure.
And the stairs rather than the elevators is not a great way of doing that.
Stairs over elevators. And I have to say to both of you, we're about a minute before our second break here, but as you've been talking, I've been lifting my microphone up so I'm not hunched down so much. But I wondered to you, Alan, you know, we hunch over our keyboards. We hunch over and we perhaps look at our computer screens incorrectly. I have two of them staring at me right at this moment, a minute before our break. What do we do about that, Alan?
Well, you talk to an economist, or you go to, you know, we have a website at Cornell that gives you the tips for how to arrange your workplace so that you don't end up hunching in that way, because over time, that is going to cause great insult to your body. You may not experience it now, but I guarantee that in 1, 2, 3, 4 years max time, you will start to experience the problems of working for prolonged periods of time in a very poor posture,
which will be in pain.
Take action now.
Well, are we going to be in pain?
Yes. No question. And the crazy thing is that people see us as magicians because they can be working in pain and we can go in and change how they work and literally, instantaneously, the pain goes away. And they go, you know, you're amazing. We go, no, we're not. We just changed how you're working. This is the way the body, if you like, is designed to work and you're just not doing that. You know, we don't go in and diagnose. We're not physicians. We don't claim any medical knowledge, but we do know about good ways of working and poor ways of working in terms of the biomechanics of the body. So we're breeding a whole generation of people. I mean, we have new syndromes now. iPad neck has become a new syndrome that wasn't around 5 years ago.
Well, let's hold on to that thought, only because we have to take that very short break, and then we'll be back to our conversation. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We are talking about the health risks of sitting too much and how to design and use our workspace, our world, to maximize movement to improve our health. And again, our guests are Alan Hedge, professor of ergonomics at Cornell University, and James Levine, director of the Mayo Clinic, also inventor of the treadmill desk. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. A comment from Joan, a standing desk has been great to reduce sitting for me. An email from Paul, before working here, I had to stand for my 8-hour shift on a narrow stand-up forklift. I had to keep both feet on the floor or the motor would cut out. Safety feature, literally painful to back and to feet. An email from Sharon, I missed the first few minutes of the show because you convinced me to jump up and down and walk up and down the long hallway in my office about 2 blocks. Thank you. You're very welcome, Sharon. Let me see what Kate from Morristown has to say. Kate, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
In 1973, right after Nixon went to China, I was there on a business trade trip. The whole country then had a policy of students holding a book in front of their face as they walked in the quad of their school. They told me that this increased the blood flow, as your guest just said just before the break, and also I believe and that it aided learning because of that, and I also think it was because they were then a poor country and it helped keep everybody warm. But everyone did this in those days in 1973.
Well, that's really interesting. And James, we've been focusing largely on the workplace, but of course, you know, children spend hours at school, sometimes at a desk, in front of a computer, perhaps not walking around reading a book, as Kate described in China.
It's sort of a wonderful image, isn't it? I'm not sure that the road safety folk would necessarily approve of the population wandering around reading books, although, you know, we don't read nearly as many books as we used to. But on a more serious note, a couple of comments. Comment one is our parks and national forestry is a massively underutilized resource in the United States. And the idea of children learning about nature amidst nature is an extremely powerful idea. We actually have a center in northern Sweden where children literally conduct their lessons, not at this time of the year, I should tell you, but during the summertime, in the forests.
Wow.
And these type of sort of reconnecting with nature, reconnecting with the greenery, and understanding our role in space and on the planet are extremely well taken by children. And as you might anticipate, any of these sort of quite advanced movement-based learning systems are associated with improved grades for children, as well as improved health. The second comment I'd like to make, and this has been very interesting to me, is that there has been a growing interest in using dynamic learning methods within the classroom. And that can not just only involve the actual furniture, standing desks. I understand there are about 28,000 standing desk units now in California, for example, but also things like sort of reciting poetry to each other whilst walking around the corridors, learning physics in the gymnasium, doing mathematics for young children, doing, you know, hopscotch as you're doing sort of the three times table, and so on. And these types of dynamic learning systems, when instituted, as I mentioned, are consistently associated with grade improvement of about 10 to 15% compared to peers. And so what I have found interesting at a practical level is when you actually go into a school is that children from the ages that we've worked in with kids from the age of 3 to high school, 18, 17, kids absolutely take to this naturally. Kids love to move if you give them permit to do so. And so I think the caller raises a really, really interesting question. And I think this is being critically examined across multiple learning institutions across the United States.
Oh, that's terrific. Kate, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And what you say, James Levine, just seems to make a lot of sense. Why wouldn't children learn better when they can be more actively involved in that learning process? Alan, let me go back to you. You talk about this 20 minutes of sitting, 8 minutes of standing, 2 minutes of moving. Is that also a way to lose weight, is being more active at work? For instance, the difference between sitting and standing. Do we see dramatic difference in terms of the use of calories, burning calories?
Well, yes, you'll see a calorie difference there. Whether you'll lose weight or not depends on whether you actually manage the calories you take in. In other words, if you compensate,
I got it.
by eating more,
right,
you won't do that. There's also some sort of anecdotal evidence from some people who've used a treadmill desk that actually they gain weight, not because it's fat, but because they're actually building muscle, and muscle weighs more per area than fat does. But yes, you should lose weight. We did a study, we published a paper about this, looking at how many extra calories per day do you need to take to go from being a sort of normal body weight to being on the borderline there of being clinically obese? And the answer was shockingly small. It was like 34 calories a day. If you can cut down your amount of energy by about 40 calories a day, you're going to lose over the course of a year. You're going to lose at least a pound, if not more, which means you're going to lose over time, you know, a reasonable amount of weight. Mm. Absolutely. If you can break things up, if you can stand when you don't need to sit, if you can move when you don't need to stand, you're going to lose weight over time. But the best way of doing it is doing it gradually, because then the body adapts and recalibrates itself. A lot of people make the mistake of going on a crash diet that puts the body in a starvation mode, and then there's a rebound effect where they can often end up gaining more weight than they originally had, because, you know, the body now is trying to store those calories in case there's another period of famine. So it's really important to think about small, gradual changes that you can make to your life to increase your activity in a sustainable way over time.
James Levine, what if I just sit all day and then I hit the gym on the way home? Does that count? James Levine, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. The first comment I'd make is if you're listening and you're a gym goer, first of all, I take my hat off to you. I mean, it is absolutely a superb behavior. Many of my friends love going to the gym, and I strongly encourage you to keep doing it. It's really, really cool. I don't. It's not my cup of tea, so to speak.
Well, and I just have to say, I don't either. I was using a fictitious me, but no, go ahead, James Levine. Go ahead.
Yes, we all have those alternate lives.
We do.
Anyway. anyway, but seriously, however, if you are a person who does get to the gym at the end of the day, and one of my, also actually, oddly enough, one of my British colleagues put it well, what she said was, how can you expect what you do for 30 minutes at the end of the day to offset the harm of the other 12 hours during the day? So again, this theme is coming back through this conversation, is that even if you go to the gym, you still have to break up your sitting time during the day. And I think the message to me that's terribly important is that this is for everybody. You can be a gym goer or a non-gym goer. You can still hold your meeting with your boss whilst walking and talking in the round and round in the corridor. You can still get up and stretch, as Alan would suggest, whilst somebody is calling you for a quick piece of telephone advice. Many of our offices can move the trash can further away or sort of relocate our printers, so you do a 5-minute walk, and so on and so forth. And so even if you're a gym goer, everything that you've heard thus far in the conversation is relevant to you as well.
Let me get Alexa from media to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Alexa, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I think the guests are very informative and offer a wealth of suggestions. But there's something that has been lacking, and that has been the importance of breath. And I find that when you're sedentary, you don't have access to your full power because we're shallow breathing. So a good and a very effective way to energize yourself when you're working is also to stand up and to breathe deeply. And when you draw more oxygen into the body, you draw that to your heart and to your brain, and to practice a little bit of laughter yoga. Because laughter yoga, you use your diaphragm and you deep breathe, and that affects your whole body, and it uplifts your spirit, and it energizes you. And people who practice laughter yoga, they go back to work feeling more relaxed but energized, and they can concentrate better and they can focus better, and it also stimulates your imagination.
Oh, well, that's great. Well, Alexa, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Alan, breathing, how important is that?
Well, I think I said earlier that when you're walking around, you're going to increase the oxygen flow to the brain. When you stand up, you can increase your respiratory intake, so the volume of your breath. It's fine. Some people, as James said, some people are very enthusiastic about things like yoga. Others, myself included, are like, we have the flexibility of a steel girder. And so, yoga just doesn't cut it for us for that. But we do it in other ways. There's good evidence to bring in something else that James said, which was about the importance of greenery. Back in the 80s, a lot of work was done on what we call restorative environments. Research showing that if you're a patient who can see greenery through your hospital bedroom window, then you recover faster than somebody who's looking out on a brick wall or who has no window at all for exactly the same kind of complaint. There's been a lot of work subsequently done on that, showing that if you also can walk around through that greenery, you end up generating more good ideas in the workplace. So, you're looking at the total picture. You're looking at individuals trying to figure out what's the best pattern of behavior for them. For some people, it may be using a treadmill desk. For other people, it may be using yoga. Going to the gym at the end of the day, one important thing about the sitting, and James knows a lot more about this than I do, but it is looking at what the biochemical effects are that happen in the body when you're sitting. And I think that there's evidence showing that certain enzymes need you to move frequently to maintain a reasonable level of the enzyme in the blood. If what you do is just exercise at the end of the day, that doesn't happen to you. And so the exercise will burn calories, but it won't have a full restorative effect on your body. So it becomes a matter of figuring out for yourself what's a sustainable way for you to change your behavior and to do it in ways that are small and manageable. And then they become second nature. They become habits and you don't even think about them.
James Levine, there was a profile of you in Outside Magazine, and the author instituted a pretty vigorous movement or exercise regime during the day, including things like push-ups and wall sitting. I'm looking at body weight squats and things like that. Should we strive to to incorporate into our daily routine these more active and vigorous and more physical kinds of movements and activities?
Oh, my goodness. Can you imagine?
I can't, actually, you know, but go ahead.
Let's go and sort of, you know, pump lift our computer screens. Can you just imagine walking to work and everyone sort of pumping their computer screens away? Anyway, I mean, to me, it's actually very interesting because there was just recently a report over the New Year about how these gyms that are sort of, you know, uber intense are sort of grabbing people's attention. And I think it's true of all sort of health initiatives, is that there are some people who do like to operate at the extreme edge. You know what I mean? And sort of moving throughout the day, I guess, can have an extreme edge too, whether that's sort of pumping this and squatting that. However, what is terribly, terribly important is, and I think as soon as one says things like this, I have patients, and I imagine them thinking, oh my goodness, now I'm excluded. No, this is really important for everybody, for normal folk who have normal jobs every day stuck behind a desk. All of us listening to the calls today can use our imaginations to find ways to get up and move throughout our days and throughout our evenings. And the bottom line to all of this is this will not only improve our health, not only help with our weight program, but also will improve our minds and our happiness and our creativity.
Alan, we can't take a call from Ted, but I see it on my computer here. He wants to know about exercises or activities, I guess, that can be done while sitting in a chair. And we're almost out of time here, but are there things that you think we could and should do to be healthier?
Yes, there are. I mean, if he does just even a quick web search, you'll find that there are a number of websites that give you activities that you can do in your chair. And there are also gadgets that you can buy to attach to your chair that let you do, for example, a little bit of resistance training. You can buy a little bicycle pedals that you can put under your chair that you can move around, you know, so that you can get that exercise while you're sitting down. So there are a variety of things that you can do. But when you do all of these things, you're still not getting that important gravitational stimulation that happens when you go from sitting to standing to moving to sitting to standing to moving. And you need to have that as well.
And our bosses and companies, are they open to all these ideas, Alan?
Actually, yes. It's a whole new area of workplace design that's called activity-based working, or in some parts of the world, agile working. And companies really are redesigning their workplaces. A country like Australia, I think, is leading the way here in redesigning their buildings. They're making stairways very prominent in the building. They're moving away from giving people assigned desks or offices to creating multiple different workspaces so that you can move between these workspaces on different days or even throughout the day. They're looking at bringing greenery into the building rather than, you know, excluding it and having it outside the building. They're looking at strategies. Even the Australian Government Taxation Office I spoke to last year is looking at strategies to increase the amount of movement that their people make throughout the day because they're well aware of the adverse effects of oversitting.
Well, it's been a delight to talk to both of you. I've learned a lot. Alan Hedge, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Good talking with you as well. And with you, James. Great as always.
Professor of ergonomics at Cornell University, James Levine, same to you. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Time for a walk. Fantastic.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
You inspired us both. Director of the Mayo Clinic, Arizona State University Solutions Initiative, and the inventor of the treadmill desk. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowaim. Thanks for joining us.